Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 10th of December, 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today in the studio, Patrick Henningsen. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Okay, well, hot off the press, it seems. Theresa, last week we reported that she said this: I will not delay Tuesday's vote. Honest gov, that's what she was saying. Well, it doesn't seem that that's quite how it's going to work out, because today she's saying, I'm delaying the vote. So there you go. She's going to make a statement apparently at 3:30 this afternoon. Lots of people telling lots of mainstream media that she is going to delay this vote. And there's going to be then a statement from the leader of the House of Commons, Andrea Leadsom, and then a statement from the Brexit Secretary on Article 50. So the question is why? Well, of course, the reason why was this. The European Court of Justice today saying this morning, or at least tweeting this out, UK is free to unilaterally revoke the notification of its intention to withdraw from the EU. So this was a case that was brought by a group of anti-Brexit politicians. It was led by the Scottish Green Party MSP Andy Whiteman, and they were arguing that the UK should be able to unilaterally halt Brexit. So they were basically wanting to make sure that no other EU nation could get in the way of us withdrawing from our withdrawal, Patrick. And so, of course, this decision came the day before the vote. And as a result, it seems that Theresa has decided to abandon the vote, at least for the meantime. So we look forward to the statement at 3:30 this afternoon, and we'll see what happens then.
Just in time, the European Court of Justice there. Great timing, very convenient. So how long would the delay of the vote be, Mike, if that's the case?
Oh, well, this is sheer speculation. Don't know what she's going to do. Is it going to be a week? Is it going to be a month? It doesn't matter. The European Court of Justice had said that Britain would be able to stay in the EU on the same terms that it's on at the moment if we decided to withdraw from the withdrawal. And they said that that withdrawal of the withdrawal would have to happen within the two-year period of since the Article 50 letter was written, which means that the deadline for that would be March the 29th. But of course, Britain has already agreed that it could delay that March the 29th deadline if it felt like it. So if, for example, we felt the need to have a second referendum and there wasn't time to do that before the 29th of March, that 29th March deadline could be delayed in order to facilitate that referendum. And then, according to the CCJ judgment, we could decide to withdraw from the withdrawal and stay in as if nothing had ever happened in the last 2 years.
So all bases are covered. Plenty of exit doors, plenty of ways to get out of the current predicament, Mike?
Absolutely. Now, the effects of that we can discuss a little later. But in the meantime, one effect of that seems to have been it's brought everybody together. So let's look at this little video clip that you found here of Boris Johnson last week.
After 2 years of negotiation, as has already been said, I think it has achieved an extraordinary thing in the sense that it has brought us together, finally. It has brought us together as Remainers and Leavers, myself, Tony Blair, we are united. The old Johnson family is united in the belief that this is I'm afraid, a national humiliation.
So if only for the fact that it's brought Boris and Tony together, Brexit has got to have been a success, right?
Well, it kind of reflects what you've been talking about, Mike, which is that if indeed this does go to a second referendum, there most certainly is going to be a turmoil in the country. There will be not definitely massive demonstrations, unrest, groups, factions pit against factions. So the right, the left, the hard right, the hard left, Mike. And then there'll be a call for national unity. We need to put the toxicity behind us. We need a centrist party, maybe as an antidote to this problem. And so I think Boris is right there with Tony Blair, Mike.
Building the foundations for this antidote.
Quite possibly.
Yeah. So, okay. But in the meantime, what's the Telegraph been saying?
After 2 years of negotiation, as has already been said, I think it has achieved an extraordinary thing in the sense...
Another case of TB. Tony Blair, asked government officials to keep all of his lucrative deals secret. This is just as he left his position as prime minister. And Blair wrote to government officials asking them to treat his multi-million pound contracts with confidentiality during the year after leaving Downing Street. And according to the Ministry of Code, the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments must be informed of all roles for 2 years, not 1 year, after leaving. And this is common practice to publish the details of the firms former ministers are working with on its website. So the Telegraph 2 years is the optimum point there. Now, the Telegraph spent 10 grand basically on getting the FOIA request through to get this information. The question is, Mike, you know, how many years ago was this? This is
since he left.
9 years ago,
yes.
Or something.
Yeah.
And now it's a scandal. So this shows you how the system is gamed in favor of people like Tony Blair, who was rinsing it with J.P. Morgan, Zurich Financial Services, Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund. Then he landed this cushy deal as a Middle East peace envoy, head of the quartet, and that turned out to be a big zero for Tony Blair. Achieved nothing, but enriched himself to no end, and still is doing it today, Mike.
Okay, well, look, let's move on to the Yellow Jackets in France. Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, we're starting to see videos now of pretty unpleasant behavior by the French authorities.
Well, here's one faction of the French police manhandling a guy in a wheelchair. So I guess the yellow vest protester in a wheelchair getting a rough treatment here. But look at the uniforms. It is interesting, the getup that they've got over on the continent. It's sort of like a cross between an S&M club and some sort of, I don't know, Devo video or something. But very interesting outfits. They put the French, they have different, obviously, divisions of the French police. But I don't think you'd see that same outfit in Britain, Mike. There's definitely a different style there.
I think it's moving in that direction, even in this country.
Yeah.
It is moving in that direction. But, of course, not just wheelchair-bound people. But this was pretty brutal. This guy seems to be getting hit in the face with a tear gas canister.
No, he's getting hit in the face with a rubber bullet, actually, I think, on this one. And if we can see, yeah, he's bleeding on the face. So shot in the face with a rubber bullet. There is a report that just came out. We didn't get a chance to get this on, but a man had his hand blown off by a stun grenade, which was fired by the French police. So an 80-year-old woman as well, Mike, we didn't include this, but she died after being hit by a tear gas canister. I think that was last week. So we have fatalities and really heavy-handed tactics that you don't see. I haven't seen these around Europe, really, Mike. And granted, these are serious protests. There's a level of thuggery that's the accusations are that the French police are very heavy-handed to the point where it's, I think it's undermining the state, actually. The public relations on this have just been a disaster for the Macron government.
Well, where does that take us then?
Well, there he is. This was the Wonder Boy. It was only a few years ago, do you remember, when he swept into power. He was billed as the next, the Tony Blair of France, Emmanuel Macron. And so things have gone a little bit sideways in the last 4 weeks. And this is a shot that I put up on social media here. This is the civilian clothes kind of, I don't know what division of the French police this is. Mind you, Mike, we have the same thing in most countries. I mean, during the G20 or the G8 protests, Britain had, groups like this, but obviously not tooled up as much as these guys. But so this is what is being pointed at the Yellow Vests protesters in France. And we've shown you the videos before this, so it makes for not a very good picture, Mike, in terms of public relations here. And what does it mean in the bigger perspective? These European leaders were just chanting, Assad must go, Assad must go, just because of the what they viewed as heavy-handed tactics, putting down the peaceful Arab Spring protesters. Of course, the evidence doesn't support that narrative. We know that there was a jihadist element being backed by foreign powers early on in the Syrian conflict, but nonetheless, no calls for Macron to go from the Western press, even though he is guilty of all the crimes that apparently all these other developing world countries are.
Well, maybe we should just for a couple of seconds discuss this issue. Do you see, you had Gerard Coleman on your Sunday Wire program last night, and he seemed to be saying that he doesn't see any particular evidence of this being a color revolution type of externally created protest. This is something that he seems to view as something that's quite organic at this point.
Absolutely. Gerard is saying, and he knows the political scene in France very well. He's written extensively on these issues. And he says this is across the board. This is all factions of society. This is, a popular uprising, essentially, in France. So no outside influence or power or nothing from the outside is driving it. That's the facts on the ground, Mike. And this is the way it was reported in the first weeks. But I said last week, give it time, give it enough time, and they'll find a way to blame the protests in France on the Russians. And of course, I was right. It didn't take too long. And so here we have Bloomberg only today. This is out of their crack investigative team last night. France to probe possible Russian influence in the Yellow Vest riots. Here it is. This is Bloomberg, Russian link sites, increased targeting of French protests, etc. So you see this has been repeated throughout various parts of the media. And what they're saying is that the protests are being amplified. This is a key word we'll come back to in a minute. This is the language that's been drifted out, amplified by Russian-linked Twitter accounts. And we see this this accusation basically attached to basically everything. So what they believe, Russian-aligned bots and so forth. So it's all very vague. But here's a neoconservative, Max Boot, saying Russia's promoting he's calling them the anti-Macron protests. So you can see where his loyalties lie. And hashtags now, Mike, are becoming criminalized. So Gilets Jaunes is the yellow vest. And of course, that's the most popular hashtag in the world, one of the most popular hashtags on Twitter for weeks now. And all of a sudden, it's being assigned to the Russians. Okay. And France as well. Imagine that, hashtagging France. That's a novel hashtag, France, according to this neoconservative Max Boot, who is, we won't get into Max, but he's also fingered Alexander Dugin. The Americans have an obsession with Dugin. It's quite comical, actually, but they think that somehow Dugin is the eminence gris behind Vladimir Putin. And this is really what they're saying is Putin is just behind everything. Putin did it. And that's the end of the analysis.
Indeed.
In the mainstream.
Well, look, videos that have been going around over the last couple of days showing these sort of armored vehicles being driven around. And what's particularly interesting is that one of them at least has an EU flag on the side, and many people asking the questions, is this representative of EU operations on the thing? So, well, the first thing to note is that the vehicle that was driving in front does not have an EU badge on it, and it also doesn't have Hermes written on the side. Here is the one with Hermes and the EU flag. And so the question is, what is Hermes? It turns out that although these vehicles aren't used very often in mainland France, they are used abroad. They were used at the weekend, as the videos show. But what seems to be going on is that the gendarmerie, the French gendarmerie, they baptize some of their vehicles. So here's one of the other vehicles that they've baptized, Zeus. I believe there's another one called Hades. And a couple of others possibly. But these particular ones that have been baptized were used recently in training exercise carried out in the framework of European partnerships at Saint-Astier, which is in the Dordogne, and the Mobile Gendarmerie Training Centre, which includes manoeuvring areas and so on. And so they were taking part in joint exercises, EU-level exercises, and that's why the EU badge was on there. Now, what the gendarmerie are saying is that the EU badge was that these vehicles also took part in some operations in Kosovo, but that wasn't when the EU badge was put on. My question, Patrick, is why was the EU badge not taken off again if it was being deployed to French streets? I believe that it's really with a view to presenting the idea of an EU badge being on the streets within the European Union. Well, what's this all about? Well, look, David Ellis had a few words to say about this at the recent defence briefing that we held in Totnes about EU military unification. And I just want to let people listen to a few seconds of this.
Now, one thing that's very, very important that you've got to get to grips with is this rotating EU enigma language that they are using. And it's we've got all got to get out there and try and dispel it. We are not dealing with a partnership. A partner would be me and Brian in business discussing what we're going to do, and we would come to an agreement. Single point command and control is not a partnership. It is fascism. It is a dictatorship. It is a tyrannical dictatorship, an armed tyrannical dictatorship that potentially will be nuclear armed. So the whole point of this is that we've got to get over to the general public that there are tax implications. There are implications for your children within conscription to this. And let's face it, there is only one thing that a unified force in Europe is going to do. Someone? What is that unified force going to do? It will be aggressive, thank you very much, sir. And who is it going to do that with? Correct. It will be as much an internal force for the civilian population as it will an external force on the Eastern Front.
So the point that David making there is that this is about internal policing as well as external police actions, you might say. And the question is, what do we have to show a little bit of this? Well, of course, we have Eurogen 4, which we can see there is the European Gendarmerie Force. France, of course, a major part of that. Italy, Spain, Turkey. Who else have we got there? Poland, a couple of the Baltic countries. Was that the Netherlands in there as well? So we've got a few countries in there. There is a European level gendarmerie. The French gendarmerie saying that they were not deployed at the weekend. But actually, can we know that? Other than the fact that they say that, we can't really know that. But what I wanted to highlight once again, of course, is to remind everybody of the European Defence Agency conference that took place in October 2015. There's Jens Stoltenberg from NATO and Federica Mogherini from the European Union. And they were talking about this exact issue, the need to merge military and civilian functions in terms of policing and police actions. And around the same time as that, in 2015, we had this tweet pushed out by NATO explaining that they were providing NATO staff with NATO operatives with non-lethal weapons. And the tweet, the little tweet, sideline tweet there really saying, well, if you put non-lethal weapons in the hands of the military, that can only be for the purpose of dealing with the types of activities that we've seen at the weekend. And at that same conference, Federica Mogherini had this to say, we need to merge military and policing functions. I find this issue of having, although the French gendarmerie saying that this EU flag on the side of their vehicle was nothing to do with EU operations, it does seem to indicate if that particular vehicle was taking part in joint EU gendarmerie training exercises that were heading in a particular direction. It seems to be a policy direction that has been expressed by both NATO and the European Union, and it's got to be an issue of concern.
Well, what's relevant to the UK, Mike, things like Operation Tempura and these things that we've seen recently, announcements about this very tactic, which is the merging of military and police functions to deal with various domestic crises. So this isn't something that is a European issue alone, Mike. This
Correct.
Is also a UK issue. And so when you talk about military unification of Europe, this, and if Britain is going to be a part of that, and if there's a second referendum, Mike, it's very possible that they will be, then it becomes an important point to address.
Well, we are strongly arguing that they are a part of it, and that whether Brexit continues in the form that Theresa May is presenting or not, whether there's any Brexit or not, defence is not part of that Brexit. We will be in that no matter what happens in the future there. Now, just a quick mention that there'll be no UK column news programme on this Friday coming, 14th of December. We're going to do a news programme on Thursday instead. So instead of Monday, Wednesday, Friday this week, it's going to be Monday, Wednesday and Thursday. And that is because Brian and I have to attend another event. We'll discuss that after. So we'll talk about that on Monday, perhaps. But that's just to let everybody know we'll be doing Friday's program on Thursday instead. Okay, let's come on to this. Yesterday, the Daily Record published this article, Secret Scottish-based Office Led InfoWars Attack on Labour and Jeremy Corbyn. What are they saying? Explosive leaked documents passed to the Sunday Mail reveal the organisation Integrity Initiative is funded with £2 million of Foreign Office cash and run by military intelligence specialists, and they've been using that money to lead an InfoWar, what they're describing as an InfoWars attack on Labour and Jeremy Corbyn. So they talk a little bit more about it being a secret UK government-funded InfoWars unit based in Scotland, sent out social media posts attacking Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. On the surface, the cryptically named Institute for Statecraft is a small charity operating from an old Victorian mill in Fife. Now, of course, it's not operating from this old Victorian mill in Fife, because as the UK column were the first to point out, this Victorian mill in Fife is derelict, empty, and partly demolished. So what did the Labour Party have to say about this? Well, here is Emily Thornberry, who said it's one of the cardinal rules of British public life that official resources should not be used for party political purposes. So it's simply outrageous that the clearly misnamed Integrity Initiative, funded by the Foreign Office to the tune of £2.25 million over the past 2 years, has routinely been using its Twitter feed to disseminate personal attacks and smears against the leader of the opposition, the Labour Party, and Labour officials. And this cannot be dismissed as something outside the government's control, given the application for funding agreed by the Foreign Office last year stated explicitly that it would be used in part to expand, quotes, the impact of the Integrity Initiative website and Twitter social media accounts. Government must now answer the following questions. Why did the Foreign Office allow public money to be spent on attempting to discredit Her Majesty's opposition? Did they know this was happening? If not, why not? And if they did, how on earth can they justify it? So the Integrity Initiative story breaking in the mainstream press a little bit here. It started off with the Daily Record. Apparently it was on the Radio 4 Today programme. It's been mentioned in other mainstream media today. But what this looks like to me, Patrick, is an attempt to sort of channel this story into one particular issue.
Mm-hmm. And a partisan issue. Make it a partisan issue.
Absolutely. But we can't allow this to happen. We've got to keep the pressure on to make sure that people understand exactly what this is. And it is a disinformation campaign against Russia. And we've already highlighted possibly some more examples of it today, with the continuing anti-Russian rhetoric. But this continues to build and becoming a little bit more hysterical on social media, in fact.
And the other point, Mike, is not just that it's a campaign, a disinformation campaign. It's a network. It's a clandestine network, admittedly, run by military intelligence specialists, run by public relations people, bureaucrats, civil servants, mainstream journalists, politicians involved, many, many different people. And this kind of secret third sector Quango network setup, Mike, that looks all too familiar if you've been watching UK column coverage over the last decade. Very much, very similar to Common Purpose, structure of organization, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, you've listed quite a range of job titles there, and many people would view that as being an absolutely huge conspiracy. But of course, the UK cluster, which included people from all the different backgrounds you mentioned there, the UK cluster had, 60 or 70 people on it? So it's not, in terms of the number of people listed as being part of this, it's quite a clique. It is quite common purpose in that respect.
I think the network is much bigger than what we saw in that spreadsheet, Mike. So I think by orders of magnitude, and there's overlapping networks on networks, and they are working together. Clearly, you can trace this, Mike, just by looking at the names that are used to quote sources in different articles.
Yes.
And from some of these integrity journalists, you can see how the network, you very easily sketch out how wide it goes. It goes all the way even to Snopes. We've got them overlapped as well in this matrix.
Well, this is a good point, because we do see journalists supporting each other, referencing each other's work. And
retweeting each other.
And therefore, in terms of search engine optimization, even if something that basic, they're therefore building their own search reputation by supporting each other.
There's that. Yeah, and it's also the endorsement, the professional endorsement from mainstream journalist to mainstream journalist, and it kind of validates whatever they're writing or talking about, even if it's a complete tripe. Which in many cases, if we look at The Guardian's output, so many different planted fake stories in The Guardian, then it becomes clear what you're looking at here.
Well, speaking of mainstream journalists, what has Carol Cadwalader been up to?
Well, she jumped on the... Well, it took her a little while, but she finally felt safe enough to jump on the integrity story, Mike. She's a writer for The Guardian and The Observer. And she's also been involved in some interesting exchanges online recently, and said some interesting things about some colleagues of ours. But this is a thread that I think people should go look at if you get a chance. So here she's put up some of these tweets by the Integrity Initiative. Only their tweets, Mike, not talking too much about the documentation, which is freely available. So she's kind of getting a hold of it, introducing it, saying, here's the Integrity Initiative story, and this is what I think about it. And as we scroll down, this is how it's characterized. And she's saying, this is based on correction, she says, hacked documents amplified by the Russian state. So see how quickly she's introduced the story, Mike. This is the mainstream journalist, Carol Cadwalader. But then she's quickly spun it, and she'll spin it in a few different directions, which we'll show you. Amplified by the Russian state. And this story, it boils down to four ill-advised retweets of opinion pieces that suggest Labor is inadvertently assisting the Russian government. So she's really downplaying the core story that's been put out by the Daily Record. And so amplified, this is a key word, this is the language that's being drifted out. So that's now a crime to amplify anything, according to this new methodology that she's applying here. Ill-advised tweets. So she's downplaying Integrity's activity, saying, oh, it's just a couple of ill-advised tweets. Nothing to see here. Move along. But then we continue on, and it's four tweets amplified by the Russian state. She's talking to Paul Mason here, another esteemed journalist in the Corps. And meanwhile, the whole of Labor front bench is silent about the mass criminality and foreign interference in the EU referendum. Why the silence? So she basically spun this to say, Labor is the problem because they've been silent on Russian interference in the EU referendum. So she's created a new conspiracy, which is Russia has interfered in Brexit, basically. So amplified, there's the key word again. And so the crime of amplification, this is the thing to beware of now. If you retweet anything, if you report on anything, you're guilty of amplification. This is what they're accusing the Russians in France of doing, amplifying the French protests, the Yellow Vest protests, because they're the only ones live streaming it. Therefore, because the mainstream media is not live streaming it, and Russia Today is live streaming it, therefore Russia's guilty of meddling or promoting the protests or something. So all the whole of mainstream media could just go down tools, don't report anything, and wait for Russia to report it, and then it becomes a Kremlin plot immediately. It's fantastic logic. But we carry on here, and this is her next one of many interesting tweets. The brilliant thing about this story, the integrity story, she says, is that it unites all the people who've ignored all the stories about Russian election interference from left and right. So she's brilliantly, in her own mind anyway, respun this again to, as a unity story. So the Integrity Initiative leaks is uniting people to fight Russian interference on both the left and the right. So you see three different spins we've shown you here, and we carry on. This, she says, this isn't politics, it's national security. It's British civilians being Novichoked on our streets by the same agency that attacked a U.S. election. So she's already thrown in the U.S. conspiracy theory there, that Russia meddled or attacked the U.S. elections, which there has never been any evidence actually produced to validate that conspiracy theory. But so she's parroting the establishment line on that. So we know Russia targeted banks. I think she might be talking about Aaron Banks.
Yes.
They're not actual banks. So we know Theresa May is trying to cover that up, she said. So she's, again...
She's accusing Theresa May of covering something up?
Yes, covering up Russian interference, I believe, in the EU referendum or some kind of criminality. So that's another distraction and deflection she's thrown out there. And so what are the people saying? The interesting thing about this, Mike, is the people get it. If you look in this thread, she's absolutely getting hammered here, being called a conspiracy theorist, and Russian involvement in the U.S. is boiling down to nothing, similar to the referendum. MI6 pushes Russians are coming line because they tow the U.S. line and it keeps their budgets flush. The Tories use it too to smear the left. It's facile. So this is just a few examples. Anyone who thinks Cadwalader was trying to suppress, anyone would think that Cadwalader was trying to suppress the expose of this op by trying to diminish its extent. What game are you playing here, Cadwalader, trying to grab the coattails of a scoop or just being disingenuous? So the good news is, Mike, that the people get Nobody's buying it. So, and you have to ask the question, Mike, is this what we're looking at here in terms of an equation? Because there's not a big difference between what Carol Cadwalader is pushing out on Twitter and what Louise Mensch, who is probably the queen of conspiracy theorists at the moment, pushes out on a daily basis. So very interesting. But it doesn't stop there, Mike. She's just done this piece just the other day for Al Jazeera. And this is basically saying that does Brexit need a Mueller investigation? So they're going full on. And obviously they've got Al Jazeera as one of their media partners to sort of drift this conspiracy theory out. This is a talking point that the Russians were involved in Brexit to such a degree it's going to require a Mueller-style investigation in the UK. And here's the Guardian's little piece a couple of, last week actually, or a week and a half ago, that basically a Trump advisor sought WikiLeaks emails via a friend of Nigel Farage. Mueller document alleges, so this was one of those pieces by John Swain here that came out around the same time as the fake Guardian story on Julian Assange. Mm. So you can see there's a kind of a propaganda ring, Mike. That's a good way to describe the Integrity Initiative. And you have these journalists defending it or trying to deflect away from it, using their positions as mainstream journalists to sort of help steer the narrative away and steer it towards where they want people to go, which is that the rush, Putin's behind everything. He's behind Brexit. He's behind the French protests. He's hacked the U.S. elections. All of these different conspiracy theories that are taken as fact just by the nature of the fact the mainstream has just been repeating them incessantly for the last 2 years.
So if the Integrity Initiative represents some kind of psychological operation run through the military, the Ministry of Defense, the Foreign Office, the military, the intelligence services, and through the mainstream media, if that's on one hand. On the other hand, we've got statements like Theresa May's statement at the G7 in July talking about the rapid response mechanism where countries, nations get together and they no longer require any evidence for anything. They've just got to build a narrative, have a common narrative, and make sure they stick to the script. Mm. So we've got Integrity Initiative and Rapid Response Mechanism. Well, take a look at this. Now, in July, the UK hosted the Western Balkans Summit in London, and this was followed up a couple of days ago with the Western Balkans Foreign Affairs Minister, and there they, Foreign Affairs Ministers meeting, and there they all are. This is the W6, that's the Western Balkans 6, and Ambassador Alison Kemp was there. And she, one of the things that she was talking about was the importance of evidence-based policy planning. Would you believe evidence-based? So she was particularly concerned about cognitive bias. She said no one is immune from cognitive bias. Cognitive bias affects everyone. There are three types that policymakers should try to avoid. Confirmation bias can lead you to only look for evidence that supports what you already believe and not to give full consideration to contrary evidence. Optimism bias leads you to believe that you're able to achieve something regardless of the evidence to the contrary, resulting in over-optimistic evaluations of cost, time and benefits. And loss aversion can result in your continued work on a project or policy, especially one that you've already invested time and money in, even when there's evidence that the project or policy will not be effective. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Patrick, but everything that you've just shown there with regarding Ms. Cadwallader and everything that is coming out of the mouths of central government at the moment leads me to believe that they are absolutely have fallen for these three types of cognitive bias. They are incapable of breaking out of them. And so they're just continuing to double down on failed narratives and lies.
The amazing thing is, Mike, you have this ambassador here, this government diplomat, laying out the problem, but there's zero internal dialogue or self-awareness within the state structures. Now, they're so in such a mode of hysteria of confirmation bias. And that really illustrates, Mike, the whole, that's the Bellingcat method of investigations. It is pure 100% confirmation bias, which is, we have the conclusion, now let's go find the evidence to support that conclusion. So it's ironic, Mike, because all of these government people complaining about this, coming up with these what they believe are intelligent words to illustrate these massive problems facing us today, that the institutions that they work within and for and with are the ones who are the most guilty of all of these things that they're warning the public about.
Well, let's look at another example of integrity and possibly confirmation bias, because a few weeks ago, of course, this story broke. Russia sends experts to Aleppo after reports of a chemical attack, and this was alleged use of chlorine in Aleppo. And, of course, it was pretty clear that this was related to the activity of some stay-behind rebels, mm-hmm. terrorists. Well, look, the British government has now put a statement out on this, so let's have a look at it. They say that the Syrian regime and its supporters have alleged that opposition forces carried out a chlorine attack on civilians in Aleppo on the 24th of November. We have seen nothing to support the claims made by Russia and Syria. The UK assesses it highly unlikely that chlorine was used in this incident, and the regime, and let's go on, sorry about that, as the regime and its Russian allies have claimed, it's highly unlikely that the opposition was responsible. It is likely that this was either a staged incident intended to frame the opposition or an operation which went wrong and from which Russia and the regime sought to take advantage. We frequently see the Syrian regime and its partners making false claims and using disinformation to cover their tracks. Allegations that the UK or its allies are in any way involved in this or in any other incident involving chemical weapons in Syria are complete fabrications. And they finished by saying, we continue to work closely with international partners to establish more fully exactly what happened. We encourage those with relevant information to share it and cooperate fully with the OPCW as it gathers information to further assess the incident. It's important for Syrians and the international community that the truth comes out.
Well, if you look at the last paragraph, this is very telling, Mike, because, by the way, this is something that would come out of Karen Pierce's mouth in the UN.
Absolutely.
It's probably written by the same person. But they're saying that the UK denies and says they would never, or any of their partners, be involved in anything like this.
We wouldn't do that, would we?
So are they saying that their partners are the militants in Idlib? Because this looks like, or this is a straw man argument, because I don't believe the Russians and the Syrian government have accused the UK
No, they haven't.
Of doing this. So what is the UK actually admitting there, that they are actually partnering with terrorist groups in Idlib? Or are they constructing a straw man argument? It's one or the other, Mike. It's one or the other. And so I thought that was worth pointing out.
Absolutely. But you know, again, they're doubling down on a narrative. They're accusing others of doing what they're doing themselves. So anyway, let's end the program then with, The Guardian had a report on Tommy Robinson.
Well, this was a front page story just a couple of days ago. You might have spied this on your way past the newsagent. Tommy Robinson made the front page of The Guardian. And the headline is provocative, to say the least, revealed the hidden global network behind Tommy Robinson. And this is a very interesting story. This is authored by three different people. And it's just under 1,000 words. So we're hoping there'll be a lot of pithy information in here, Mike, with three authors crammed into less than 1,000 words. But it's The Guardian, so we don't know what we'll get. But let's have a look at this. So they're saying this is Tommy Robinson's global network. And here's the first source of support for Tommy Robinson. A Philadelphia-based think tank, the Middle East Forum, acknowledges it's been basically paying his legal fees. Quite a lot of money, Mike, by the way, 60 grand or so in change. And so this is for his demonstrations as well, staged in London. They're picking up the bill for that. So The Guardian's saying this is a foreign source of support. We'll get back to this in a minute. Interesting. Here's another foreign source of support. U.S. tech billionaire Robert Shulman financed a fellowship and helped pay for Tommy to be employed in 2017 by Rebel Media. Okay, and this is $5,000 a month. That's not a bad part-time salary.
Not bad.
To go out and scream in a couple of YouTube videos a week. Not bad at all. So, and here's another foreign support source. The Australian Liberty Alliance helped fund Tommy as well. He's got quite a bit of change accumulating in his bank account, Mike. This is interesting. But it gets more interesting. The New York City think tank, the Gatestone Institute, also supporting Tommy, giving him a lot of public relations support. And the last one, David Horowitz Freedom Center, here, it's a Southern California-based so-called think tank, although I don't think they do a lot of thinking there. The School for Political Warfare published a series of pieces defending Tommy and lobbied for him to go talk to U.S. Congress. Amazing if that ever happened.
Now The Guardian here is saying that these are all right wing.
They're saying these are all right wing international sources of support for Tommy, but with all these crack journalists at The Guardian, there's just something interesting. They left out the word Israel with all of these sources. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different sources, Mike. Let's start with the Middle East Forum. Absolutely, 100%. An arm of the Israeli lobby, no doubt about it. And if you have any questions about this, just type in Middle East Forum and Israel into your search engine and see how many hundreds of pages come up, and you can see exactly what they do, the work they do. It's amazing. And again, Rebel Media, this is run by a committed Zionist. And by the way, they take all the Rebel Media staff for an induction week in Israel. And, of course, Tommy, I think, went along for one of those trips, so very much in line and aligned with the Israeli lobby. And, again, the Australian Liberty Alliance acts as a kind of a PR arm for Israeli interests in Australia, do a lot of campaigning for Israel. They're basically an arm of the Israeli lobby, unofficially. The same with the Gatestone Institute in New York. Provide a great PR oracle for the Israeli lobby, one of many, by the way, in the United States, undeniable, in fact, and the same with David Horowitz Freedom Foundation, which was actually an ex-Marxist organization turned into a right-wing think tank. So it was taken over at some point and transformed into another kind of tentacle of the Israeli public relations machine in America. There you go, Mike. That's the story. And they left out, there's no mention of Israeli influence in this article at all. So completely left out of everything, basically. But we have a little team photo here of Tommy. I think, let me see, there he is, on top of an IDF tank in Israel. So if you have any questions about Did he go? What are his loyalty? Where his loyalties lie? And any further questions? Well, nice T-shirt, Tommy. So, but all of this is just ignored by the Guardian. So it seems to be an article, Mike, that's critical of Tommy Robinson. That's the way it looks. But what it does is it completely whitewashes the fact that his base, he has a huge, his core base is Israeli internationally.
Yeah.
His international support base is the Israeli lobby, effectively, through all five organizations which we showed. So what does this make this article by The Guardian? Well, it's another fake news fail from The Guardian. So can you trust The Guardian to do any honest reporting? This is becoming a difficult question, Mike.
I don't think it's a difficult question at all. The answer is no. And we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Patrick, for that. And thank you for joining us today. We will be back at the same time on Wednesday, 1 p.m., live on ukcolumn.org and Facebook and other places as well. And another brief reminder that we won't be doing a news program on Friday. We'll be doing it on Thursday instead this week. So join us for that as well. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.